seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Lewis and Lambert Metal Contractors Incorporated versus Donna Jackson and Teresa Holly individually, and his next friend of Dovin Holly and Kieran T. Holly from Dallas County. Mercedes-Benz Credit Corporation versus Marcella Ryan from Hidalgo County, and CMMC versus Ambrosio Salinas from Williamson County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and will conclude these arguments before noon. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of our court. If you wish to purchase a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner Lewis and Lambert versus Jackson.
May it please the court, Mr. David Keltner and Ms. Michelle McCoy will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Keltner will open with the first 10 minutes.
If it pleases the court, there are two straightforward issues in this case. The first is whether employees of an employer who contract for services that primarily benefit a business, but which incidentally benefit the employees, can be consumers under the DTPA. And the second point is whether the defendants are entitled to a dollar-for-dollar settlement credit when other defendants have settled a case in a DTPA breach of warranty suit. I'm going to address the consumer issue, and Ms. McCoy will address the credit issue. The question of who is a consumer has been plaguing Texas courts for a long time, ever since the passage of the DTPA. This court recently has had four occasions in which to look at the issue. In Parkway versus Woodruff and Doe versus Dallas Board Club, this court did not have to reach the consumer issue and footnoted in both of those cases that it was not considering the issue. In the U.S. brass cases, the court has granted writ, heard argument in October, and those have not yet been decided. And Arthur Anderson versus Perry Equipment is here before you on writ. The real truth of the matter is the DTPA in 1745-4 defines a consumer as an individual who seeks or acquires goods or services by purchase or lease. Really a pretty simple definition, and there's not much problem in the normal consumer transaction. When a plaintiff who purchases or acquires services directly from a seller, when we have that fact situation, courts haven't had any difficulty. The question comes when the plaintiff does not actually purchase directly or does not acquire directly the services from the seller, and that's the case we have here. It is our opinion that in those circumstances, unless there is a direct benefit, unless that person is an intended beneficiary, they are not a consumer. Now, that doesn't mean that there is not a recovery. In fact, this case is a classic example of this. As this court knows, this case was originally tried on theories of negligence, products liability, both 402A and B, tried to a jury. There was a recovery for negligence. We do not dispute that here. And in fact, the real reason that the plaintiff doesn't want to take that is there were contributory negligence findings to both the individual plaintiffs that would essentially bar any recovery that they would get.
Mr. Kaplan, did yes, Donna sir? Jackson and Teresa Holly directly benefit from the air conditioning system and
no,
ventilation
sir.
System?
I do not believe they did. And let me tell you, Your Honor, why I believe that's the case. In looking at the cases this court has previously considered and other courts around the state, I think it's clear that they were incidental beneficiaries. And let me first talk about the Brandon case from the Austin Court of Appeals, decided by Judge Abusi early in 1995. In that case, very similar to here, Seton Medical Center contracted with someone to make sure all of its equipment was sterilized. That's a dangerous process that involves toxic gases to sterilize various items. And they contracted also for a maintenance agreement. And in that case, in Brandon, Ms. Brandon was injured through exposure to the gases, allegedly because the maintenance was not done correctly. And the question was she an incidental beneficiary because she was certainly the one handling the sterilization equipment, doing the sterilization of the instruments, or was this something that was primarily contracted for to benefit the company. Judge Abusi came to the conclusion that it was primarily for the company and that otherwise you would open up types of claims for anybody involved. Now,
counsel, as opposed to that situation in these other cases, wouldn't you agree that there were only three people who were going to benefit from the repairs to this system, and that were the two plaintiffs involved in this case and one other person?
Your Honor, that's partially true, and yes, we would have to admit that there's no doubt there were a small number of people who would benefit from the vent, which was a small part of the project we worked on. But I think you have to concentrate on all the facts that Lewis and Lambert did. Remember, Lewis and Lambert was the subcontractor of a subcontractor of a general contractor, the only party in this case with which, of course, the hospital had a contract. The vent system was there to protect anybody who was in the lab. And there were other people who visited the lab. In fact, there was testimony at trial from a doctor who visited and others who did on a routine basis. So therefore, although three people worked in the lab a significant amount of the time, and I think that's very, it certainly does slice down the group of people, the truth of the matter is there were more people that could have been benefited and were directly benefited, and I think that's important.
What about a second issue, and that is somewhat the but-for test, and that is that these changes would not have been made but for the complaints and the request by the plaintiffs in this lawsuit?
Your Honor, that another excellent question, especially when you read the face of the Court of Appeals opinion. We have taken an unusual step in this, at least for me and for our firm, of contesting the statement of facts in the Court of Appeals opinion. And in fact, in the supplement that we've handed out to you today, I've taken all of the record sites that are from the appellant's brief on this issue. There isn't evidence of that. The truth of the matter...
There is or is not?
Is not. And in fact, what you're going to find is that Lewis and Lambert, in fact, the man at the hospital, the administrator, who contracted actually with another contractor on this issue, never talked to Lewis and Lambert about it. Let me be fair. There's no doubt that in response to those complaints, Lewis and Lambert did come out and do some remedial work on the issues. But does the mere fact that there has been a complaint confer consumer status on an employee who makes a complaint to someone else, who makes it yet to a third and fourth, and in this situation, probably a fifth and sixth person to correct it? I don't think so. And I think we can look at this court's opinions to reach that determination. The case relied primarily, that the plaintiffs rely on is Kennedy versus Safe. And there's no doubt in that case that this court found that there was some direct relationship and goods and services were acquired. It was also a situation in which there's no doubt that the goods and services were acquired by the company and purchased by the company, but for some benefit to the employees. But I ask you to remember that case and remember specific items about the case because they're important. And I don't do this normally, but at 892 of the opinion, the court says precisely what it means. And in that case, if you remember, we had a situation where we were dealing with a insurance, group insurance issue. No doubt that the employer paid for it. No doubt that the employer intended to benefit precisely employees. There was a meeting at which the plaintiff appeared and heard a sales pitch in which misrepresentations were made. As the court says in their opinion, there is no doubt that this person, the plaintiff, was covered by the insurance. And more importantly, that they were named insured. They had a very precise acquisition of services. And at page 892, the court said, yeah, in that situation, there was a situation in which the employee acquired direct and primary benefit. That's completely different from what we're talking about here. The El Paso court took up the same issue in Hernandez versus Casco. And Judge Barajas, writing for that court, said the same thing. He said, listen, when you're talking about all this, there are obviously instances in which employers are going to purchase things for their business. But the issue really on acquisition, which is, remember, acquire is part of the definition. And the question is, what do they acquire? He defined acquire to mean, and I think it is the best definition, and quite frankly, the only definition that I can find of the term acquire as it's used. He does it this way. He says it means to get or come to have is one's own. And he said that's what the Supreme Court was saying in Kennedy versus Sale. I also think that's what the court in the early and mid-80s was talking about in Cameron and Flanagan. And I wanted to address those briefly for you because I think they can become important. In Cameron, also relied upon heavily by the plaintiffs, mentioned in Parkway versus Woodruff is a case this court would consider in determining consumer status. The Supreme Court looked at a situation where a purchaser of a house relied on representations made in a multiple listing service, an MLS book, by the not his own realtor, but the realtor for the other party. And the question was, did they acquire any goods or services in the transaction? And if you look at that opinion at page 539, this court says is they acquired the house and services that went with it, all of which were related to the opposite side of the transaction of which the realtor was an agent. There was an acquisition of services there. There is not an acquisition of services here. Flanagan, same situation, a little bit different. And in that situation, a couple wanted to build a house, contracted with somebody as a contractor. The contractor went to the bank, sold the contract. And the bank then becomes a party, and unfortunately the contractor leaves after doing only 20% of the work. And the fascinating thing there is the bank forecloses and a consumer claim is brought. Now, again, what this court says is there were some services and goods acquired with the house. It's something that they owned. They reduced it to their possession. It was theirs. Or as Judge Baraha says, it was to have is one's own. Cases on the other side are clear, Brandon especially, and Brandon is the one we really ask you to rely on. In those cases, the employer goes out, gets something of benefit that is primary benefit for the company. It has an incidental benefit for the employee, and they are not consumers. Same result reached in Lara versus Lyle, where the court said exactly the same thing. And in those, in Munoz versus Gulf Oil, same situation where the court repeatedly says primary benefit for one, for the employer, incidental benefit for the employee, there is no consumer status. The reason for that is clear. If we don't have this test, everybody who's an employer of a large corporation who takes services is going to be a consumer. One of the things I think the court has to look at in drafting this opinion, because this issue has come up twice before and the court didn't reach it, and it's before the court in other cases, is this. What do you want to say a consumer is? What restrictions do you want to put on this downstream person? I think first it's a primary benefit, except the Brandon test. It's a primary benefit of the employer with incidental benefit, although safety is always important, as the court in Lara said, that it is the primary versus incidental benefit test. I think that's most important, and this court does not have to overrule one case it has ever written in the past to make that holding and reject consumer status here. Also, I think you ought to consider adopting the Hernandez statement of Judge Barajas, where he says that acquire means reduce to one's own. That's Kennedy versus Sales, it's Cameron, it's Flanagan. The court does not have to overrule one of these cases to reach that decision. In another case, I know in the Arthur Anderson versus Prairie Equipment case, it has also been urged that both sides intend. In other words, the seller and the purchaser both intend that the benefit go primarily on one side, either to the employer, which would be no consumer employee for consumer status. I think that's worth considering as well. Again, the court, I don't think, would have to, even under that circumstance, overrule any of the cases that has previously decided. I'm going to turn it over to Ms. McCoy to take the rest of the arguments on the credit.
May it please the court. In the time remaining, I'd like to briefly address why Lewis and Lambert is entitled to a dollar-for-dollar credit, regardless of whether the judgment is based on negligence or the DTPA, for the amounts that the plaintiffs received before trial from the four settling defendants. In this regard, I'd like to emphasize three points. First of all, in this case, there's no dispute that we're dealing with a single, indivisible injury.
Second, the jury question that was submitted to the jury, questions 11 and 12, asked the jury to determine the total amount of damages sustained by the plaintiff. It wasn't specifically limited to what the conduct allegedly attributed to Lewis and Lambert. In those findings, the jury attributed $1,366,000 in actual damages to Ms. Holly. She received from the settling defendants $1,365,000. Ms. Jackson, the jury awarded her $200,000 in actual damages. Before trial, she had received $140,000 from the settling defendants. The third point I'd like to make is that the plaintiff voluntarily pursued a DTPA recovery under their breach of warranty finding. As Mr. Keltner mentioned, instead of going with the negligence finding, the plaintiff wanted to avoid the 49% contributory negligence finding and also the dollar-for-dollar credit that the plaintiffs don't dispute applies under that scenario. They wanted to take advantage of the benefits of the DTPA recovery in terms of a less stringent causation standard, the ability to potentially recover extra damages and attorney fees. However, the Court of Appeals in this case erred in improperly allowing the plaintiff to escape the consequences, and that is the application of the original contribution scheme.
Counsel, go ahead.
Respondent says that you can cite no case that applies the original contribution scheme to a plaintiff's personal injury recovery under multiple theories, including breach of warranty. Is that true?
That's correct, Your Honor. Incorrect, Your Honor. We can cite this court to its decisions in Stewart Title versus Sterling and First Title versus Garrett. Specifically,
those personal injury cases?
They were not personal injury cases. However, Your Honor, the court did not specifically make an exception or did not make that distinction in those cases. The court,
so you can't cite a personal injury case, but you say that those cases were not limited and would include personal injury.
The DDPA recovery, this court held that the original contribution statute and accordingly the dollar-for-dollar credit applies.
One other question. Is it your position that the Duncan analysis applies only to products-related cases?
Your Honor, our position is that the plaintiff had the opportunity to pursue a common law breach of warranty claim. Duncan would apply in that instance. However, they chose to pursue it under the DTBA. Under those circumstances and under this court's holdings in Stewart Title and First Title, the original contribution statute and not Duncan applies under these circumstances.
Did you have 3 points or 4 points?
Those were my 3 points, Your Honor.
There was a dispute on the mulch, and that was wrong. Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Russell McNamee will present argument.
May it please the court, I'm Russell McMaines, co-counsel for the respondent, Teresa Holly, and also here to make an argument that is essentially similar on behalf of Donald Jackson, who is has independent counsel, but our arguments are similar and related insofar as the two issues that are posed by the petitioners is concerned. I'd like to initially take a considerable issue with the alleged misstatement of facts by the Court of Appeals, because I think that even the documents that are supplied by the petitioner establish just the contrary. In fact, in the document that the petitioners have filed this morning, in segment B, under tab B, page 1321 of the record, involving testimony from Donna Jackson, inquiry is, do you recall telling any of the people with hard hats that you didn't think the ventilation was working properly? Yes. What was their response? It seems like one time someone did check and said, you're right, that's not working. What did you do at that point? At one point, I told the administration, talked to Dr. Herring, we closed the lab down, we got a contractor to send the prostheses out to be done outside the hospital. They are the ones who requested the repair services. They are the ones who made the requests. There are other places in the record, including the administrator, Mr. Roberts, who testified repeatedly on these issues. There is a direct request for the services in regards to the repair of the ventilation system, as found by the Court of Appeals.
To your case, have they not made a direct request, would you be arguing this case before us tonight?
Well, I probably would have lost at the Court of Appeals, to be candid about it, if there had not been an actual request or input by them in the original
system. Is that essential to your theory of liability under the DTPA?
The theory, well, in terms of consumer status?
Yes.
Our position in the consumer status is they did seek or acquire the services
in question. But does that hinge on their direct request for the repair services?
It hinges, as I read the cases, on them being direct beneficiaries, in essence, of the service.
But does that have anything to do with the fact that they asked for the repairs? If they had said nothing and the repairs had been made, would they still be beneficiaries under your rationale?
Yeah, or if you're asking me that the fact that they didn't ask the contractor, Lewis and Lambert, as opposed to asking their people to do it?
Or if someone else had asked for the repairs, other than your client, and the repairs were made.
The cases do make that distinction, Your Honor. In fact, the Hernandez case specifically says, and it's relied upon by them, and the specific distinction in Hernandez is on page 634 of the opinion, where it says, indeed, the facts clearly establish that Hernandez did not request or ask for the goods. Now, in regards to one of the cases that specifically that we have relied on, the Superior Trucks versus Allen case, there is a specific notion, even though there is no purchase made by the individual in question, again, following a line of cases that says there's no privity of contract required, they did ask for it and did seek it. And the seeker need not be the purchaser, just as the court said in Kennedy versus Sale that the acquirer need not be the purchaser in order to be a consumer and qualify as a consumer under the Act, which is to be liberally construed under Cameron versus Terrell and Garrett, which this court has held consistently since 1983. So with a liberal construction of the Act, and the question is whether or not the consumer status issue was simply, was there a seeking or acquiring of goods to be purchased or leased. In fact, the purchase or lease doesn't have to even be consummated in order to qualify as a consumer. And is the gist of the complaint of the consumer related to the transaction? That is, do they have a relationship to the transaction? They do have that relationship in this case to the transactions. They were the only people using this equipment. They were the people who shut down the lab because this stuff wasn't working. They were the people who went back to work on the basis that it was working. There is no dispute in this case on breach of warranty. There has never been any kind of attack on the breach of warranty findings at any level by the defendants in this case, either at the trial level or at the court of appeals level. Breach of warranty is actually independent of the DTPA. It's not a statutory cause of action per se. Rather, the DTPA is a supplementary remedy with regards to breach of warranty. They have therefore committed a breach of warranty, basically admitted and uncontested by the other side. The DTPA is to be liberally construed with regards to the redress of those breach of warranty.
So if there were 300 people working in this lab and 50 of them signed a petition requesting this event, they would have DTPA status and the other 250 wouldn't, unless they made some oral.
If this court is to follow the Hernandez distinction that is argued by the petitioners, then the answer to that is yes. In point of fact, in terms of the request for a particular repair service, Laura Casco, the other cases, Laura is a vehicular collision, or basically a running over of someone. And the suggestion is that somehow that they are an acquirer of the services of the trucking company, who of course were not hired to run over anybody. They were hired to transport some culprits. And the argument was that tangentially they were supposed to do it safely. This is not an argument on tangential safety. In fact, the record establishes that in the beginning, Donna Jackson had input in the design of the ventilation system in this case, because that's where they were working. They were working in a closed room facility for the first time when this new part of the hospital was being opened. And the administrator confirms all of that. Those findings are made by the trial judge in essentially a letter of opinion that the trial judge wrote, which is why he made the determination he made in the first place.
Mr. McMaines, what about Mr. Keltner's analysis that reduces the issue down to whether or not the repairs have been reduced to one's own?
Your Honor, again, the argument that he is making with regards to the acquiring is not an argument relating to services. It's an argument that he is relating to the question of goods. But the word acquire also modifies in the statute the term services. How does one acquire services? And the notion that they reduce them to their own is really, I mean, in the Hernandez case, The specific distinction argued by the court is they didn't request the dock levelers in question. They didn't ask for them. They weren't purchased for them. Superior Trucks versus Allen is a case in which there was the request and there was a purchase by someone else. And the court says he doesn't have to make the purchase in order to qualify as a consumer. That's one of the lead cases that is relied upon by the Court of Appeals, and correctly so. Ultimately, the argument is made, well, we need to look at Brandon, because we think Brandon is very close. But Brandon specifically has this quotation in it. In 880 Southwest 2nd 488 says, we agree with the analysis of the consumer's issue status as set forth by the Lahr and Casco courts. An employee is entitled to consumer status under the DTPA on claims involving goods or services an employer purchases primarily for the employee's benefit. And there is evidence to support the purchase of these repair services, in this case primarily for the benefit of the employees, and at their request, they both sought and acquired. There is ample evidence to support that, and ample evidence to support the consumer status issue. But we frankly submit that from the standpoint of the record, from the standpoint of the cases, that you would have to depart from the cases in order to take the position that an employee who specifically seeks or who specifically acquires a service simply because he didn't pay for it, or simply because it was paid for ultimately by a series of contracting arrangements, that they are denied consumer status. This court consistently, in the DFW commercial roofing, or courts of appeals have consistently, in DFW versus commercial roofing versus Merritt, have specifically said there is no privity requirements. One who acquires need not be a purchaser. Those are roof services purchased by the warehouse owner, and it's the person who has goods in the warehouse that is suing. He is an acquirer. No privity is required. Doesn't matter that there has to be, that there was a contract. Joseph versus PPG Industries is a materialman supplying defective windows to a general contractor, and the building purchaser is still considered to be a consumer in that case. Had the windows been specifically requested by one of the tenants, we submit that so would that tenant be a consumer under the rationale in Joseph versus PPG, DFW, Flanagan, and all of the other cases. This is a backhanded attempt to introduce notions of privity. Notice that the cute way in which the response was made, well, didn't they seek to acquire the services? Well, no, actually, they complained to their employer, who then they had a general contractor, and they're actually a sub of the general. They're the people responsible for doing the ventilation system. There's no question about that. There's a breach of warranty finding. No question about that. Breach of warranty duty, they don't have any question about that. Didn't object to the submission of the breach of warranty issue at all, except to suggest that it should be a proximate cause issue and not a producing cause issue because they're not a consumer. That's the only complaint that they had.
Moving from on away from the liability issue, assuming that we were not to agree with you and do not have consumer, clients would not have consumer status, can you tell us on the crediting issue how you would say the credit should be applied and why?
Well, yes, I'd be glad to deal with the credit issue and move to it at this point. The point on the dollar-for-dollar credit issue is quite simply a question of does Duncan apply to this situation, to a breach of warranty case? Duncan says on its face it applies to a breach of warranty case in a case that is essentially a tort case, that is one for personal injury or property damage. Now, there's an attempt to gloss over this notion of a distinction between personal injury and property damage cases and consequently economic loss cases. And that's exactly what the other side has done in these cases, is in my judgment, a glossing over. Stewart, Cameron, none of those cases did involve anything but economic losses. Rather, and consequential economic losses, they are not in the nature of the very tort concepts that were dealt with in Duncan. And that is damage to person or property. It is physical damage to person or property that has justified the application of Duncan. Duncan specifically says, in cases where there are mixed theories of liability submitted and found, specifically including strict liability and breach of warranty, express or implied, when that happens, then this scheme applies. And that scheme is no credit. That's what the Duncan case so holds. The irony of it is...
Why do we exclude application of the old comparative negligence statute?
I'm sorry?
Why do we exclude the comparative negligence statute when there's negligence finding?
Because the Supreme Court in Duncan specifically was dealing with the problem of when you have mixed liability findings, that is negligence and something else, that the comparative negligence statute as it existed at the time of Duncan only applied to negligence cases.
Why do we draw a distinction between, as you put it, physical damage as opposed to economic loss? What's the rationale for that?
Because that's the nature of the tort concept. That from 1984, which is when Duncan was written, in 1984, we were dealing with a concern for tort in terms of contribution rights. You had rights of contribution for tortfeasors. There were no cases at that time actually suggesting that some kind of breach of warranty damage under the UCC for economic loss constituted a tort for which there was contribution. There isn't contribution accorded under the UCC. There isn't contribution accorded to economic losses. Those distinctions have been specifically made by the court since the 70s in the Mid-Continent Aircraft case, which is a case that I actually argued before the court back in 1978. The case basically says when there's damage to the product itself based on breach of warranty and no damage to anything else, it's not a tort. It doesn't rise to the level of tort. But when there is damage to something else, when there is some physical damage, when that's the nature of the injuries involved, is one that sounds in tort, then we can deal with concepts of tort. That's where the entire issue of rights of contribution existed at all, is because of tort. That's the requirement under the old 2212, which is now Chapter 32, which is the scheme that is argued that should be applied, required findings of joint several liability, joint tort features, that they be tort features. The notion that somehow the DTPA and insurance code were, quote, statutory torts and creature of statute, is one that basically was injected by the courts, essentially in stir for the first time. Now, the entire contribution issue under the DTPA was raised after it had been determined that there was no right of contribution or indemnity by the El Paso Court of Appeals, and legislature responded and said you get contribution or indemnity as the law would require. Gives you no specification as to what system it is. This court writing in Plastex says that just means you get it as you do in ordinary cases. In other words, you look at the type of case it is to see what kind of scheme applies. This case is clearly a Duncan scheme. If we have a proximate cause issue here, in addition to a producing cause issue, there's absolutely no question that Duncan applies. The argument is that somehow you should be deprived of the right of recovery because you are a consumer and because you have elected to try your case on a DTPA supplemental remedy for a warranty that exists outside the DTPA and exists at common law, which is precisely the type of common law warranties that were dealt with in Duncan, that somehow we should penalize people who are consumers for using the DTPA. That we should get a worse result in the DTPA than we get otherwise if we were to apply ordinary warranty law when there's no contest on there being a breach of warranty. That's absurd. The courts have consistently held, this court has consistently held, that the DTPA must be liberally construed to effectuate its purposes, which are to secure remedies for breaches of warranty.
If we held that there's no liability under the DTPA, you're left with a negligence claim. Is that correct?
Well, that's not actually true. We do have, as I said, we have an uncontested breach of warranty issue. The fact of the matter is, from a procedural standpoint, their only complaint to the breach of warranty issue is their suggestion is, well, you don't get it under the DTPA. The court thought we did when they submitted it, thought that it was a question of law. In reality, the only way that issue is raised is by way of an objection to the submission of the producing cause issue, saying that it should be proximate cause. You don't waive the cause of action in common law for breach of warranty. The breach of warranty exists independently, and therefore the only remedy actually that they would be entitled to, if that were true, that somehow we were denied consumer status, would be a remand for the simple reason that, as this court held, as I think Justice Heck held in Spencer versus Eagle Star, you sustain an objection to the charge, you get a retrial. And it's not a question of saying that you have waived an entire ground of recovery. We haven't. It's not a ground anyway. It's a supplemental remedy under the statute that we were entitled to take advantage of. So this is an overstatement, really, of the effect, anyway, of the submission of the producing cause issue. They have no contest on this being a breach of warranty. They have no contest, and they're really, the facts in this record are essentially undisputed, that this ventilation system was not working, never really worked, that certainly when they repaired it and told everybody they could go back, it still didn't work. That's what resulted in their injuries. There's ample testimony to support that. None of that's contested.
Mr. McMahon, are you saying that you received a separate jury question on breach of warranty unrelated to the DTPA question?
No, what I'm saying is that the breach of warranty question is not a DTPA question per se. The producing cause aspect of it.
So you got a damage finding on breach of warranty.
We have a damage finding based on a breach of warranty, which does have a causation element of producing cause.
If that's the case, would that mean that contributory negligence would not apply to a breach of warranty?
If we did not get the advantage of the supplemental remedy, and if, in fact, you were to, and because of the fact we don't have approximate cause submission one way or the other, the trial court held that it was not necessary. And that was their, and that basically is their complaint based on this consumer issue. If it should have been proximate cause, then really all that is a remand point. We're not suggesting that there is an independent grounds to affirm at this level. I'm not attempting to borrow the proximate cause finding in the negligence case. Clearly, if this was a straight common law breach of warranty case with no effort to invoke the DTPA, which we did in this case, then the contrib findings would apply. The credit principles clearly would not have applied. There is no way they can squeeze out Duncan. Their argument is simply that somehow, because you put the overlay of the DTPA in it, that Sterling trumps Duncan, and that's not what Sterling said. And there's no rationale for suggesting that that's what it says. It says that in cases in which you are not otherwise controlled by Duncan, or specifically by another contribution scheme, then we will go to what is Chapter 32. This case is specifically controlled by Duncan. It is a breach of warranty in a tort context for physical injury. And that is the essence of
Duncan. Assuming we disagree with you down the line and you were left with a comparative negligence finding, how would you apply the credit in that situation?
Well, there's no question that under Chapter 33, as it existed at the time, was solely a negligence question, that the credit principles would basically wipe out the recoveries of both parties. We don't have any contest on it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, some brief rebuttal. Let me answer some of the questions that were asked from the bench and also respond to a number of Mr. McMahon's arguments. His argument basically is you didn't read Duncan. Duncan controls the case. Here's the question I have for the court. Everybody admits, and you just heard Mr. McMahon's admit, that if this were a negligence-only recovery, the credit would apply. No doubt about that. Credit applies, and there would be no net recovery. And that's important. The second thing is, Stewart Title, first title from this court, say that in DTPA, the old contribution statute, original contribution statute, applies. I will admit, Judge Abbott, I would say Judge Cornyn, I'd say it's true. These are not personal injury cases, and none that we cite to you are, and I will admit that. But under those cases, the original contribution statute applies. The Houston court and the Dallas court in Hamra most recently say even in implied warranty cases under the DTPA, there's no doubt that the original applies. My question to you is, if the original applies in negligence and then it also applies under the DTPA for implied warranty, so we get a dollar-for-dollar credit, how come when they're mixed, we don't? And I think the answer, Judge Abbott, was in your question, and that was Duncan limited to a strict liability or products liability question? in the case, I must admit to you, the answer is no. The case doesn't say that. It says what Mr. McMahon said it said. When you have a mixed theories of law, which are could be including warranty, and I think they were talking about common law warranty, and I think they were talking and the products liability, strict liability, and the like, then you go to Duncan. But the truth of the matter was, I think that's what it meant anyway, although it didn't say it, because it makes no sense to say when you throw in two cases or two causes of action, either of which the original contribution statute applies to, and either one you get a dollar credit, but when you combine them, you don't. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, and I don't think it makes sense to the jurisprudence of the court. I also disagree with one other thing Mr. McMahon said. Remember, he said, wait a minute, you're punishing people for use of the DTPA. You come out worse than you ordinarily would have come out under negligence. Not so. And this case proves that fact. This case got tried in serious contribution. 49% was found against both of these plaintiffs. That significantly reduced their recovery. They had originally sued the people who designed this system, the people who did the mechanics. They said, we did the ventilation system. Don't be fooled by that. Yes, we did the venting system, but the fan and the mechanics to that were done by the mechanical contractor who was the sub above us. And it is those people that sued for this one injury. And the truth of the matter is they didn't want to take negligence because it didn't give them a recovery with the contrib in the negligence finding. They didn't get the product liability finding they wanted from the jury. The judge took away, the 402A was found against them by the jury. The judge took away 402B because this wasn't a 402B case. That's not appealed here. They don't contest that.
Can judgment be rendered on the verdict for breach of warranty?
Absolutely.
Apart from the DTPA?
Yes, sir. No doubt about it. And I will admit, Justice Heck, he is right. There is this court found in the Parkway decision, there's no doubt that the breach of warranty theory under the DTPA relies on common law. I mean, that's what the breach of warranty is. You're just entitled, if you get under it, to use DTPA to get damages. But think about the enhancements you have. You have attorney's fees, which are not, you don't get under regular, regular breach of warranty findings in common law. You get producing cause rather than proximate cause, which was submitted here, and the judge believed it was producing cause because it was under the DTPA. So you get all that benefit.
Any other questions?
I'm sorry.
Well, a follow-up on what Justice Heck asked, and that is, would it not require a remand?
No, it does not.
Why not?
I don't think it requires a remand for two reasons. The issue of a credit, if it is dollar for dollar, can apply after the judgment. That's the beauty of a dollar-for-dollar credit. This case was submitted as producing cause over our objection. It is a DTPA case. That's why you have the attorney's fees in it. Otherwise, the court wouldn't have rendered judgment for attorney's fees and the like. It can be rendered because that's the basis on which it was tried to get the enhanced recovery for attorney fees and shot at additional damages. Remember, Judge, this was question 9 in the charge. If you look, if there's any doubt about this, look at question 10. It is the knowing question from the DTPA that's predicated on question 9, and I think that answers the question.
Any other questions?
Did Ms. Holly make the direct request for repair services?
No, sir. And let me explain that, and I want to be as concise with this as I can be. She did make a direct request, it appears, to the hospital folks. The things that Mr. McMahon's talked about the hard hats there, yes, that's in the record. But no idea who those people were, whether they're Lewis and Lambert or otherwise. It's important for you to remember that the hospital administrator, who she says in her brief, in the Court of Appeal says, in their opinion she did talk to, say, he says, I didn't deal with Lewis and Lambert, I dealt with people above them. I also want to be very candid with you. There is no doubt that Lewis and Lambert came out to fix the vent problem once the complaints were made.
In response to her complaint?
It would appear so, although that's not tied up in the record. You certainly could draw that inference, and I don't want to suggest that you could not draw that inference.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.